This is Seth Koch with the Southern Oral History Program in the Department of American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's October 13th, 2014, and I'm here on the Carolina campus with Harry Amana, Professor Emeritus in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and recent inductee into the UNC Journalism Hall of Fame. You were just talking about you grew up in Philadelphia?
I grew up in Philadelphia, went to Temple, and I have it's a checkered history. Got out of high school in 59 and got a track scholarship to go to Temple, but actually punched out after 2 years and joined the military. Came to South Carolina for basic training and stuff after that. Spent most of the time I was in the service, I spent almost 2 years in Iran and under the Shah. Came back and went back to Temple. And while I was at Temple, I graduated from Temple in 67 and then 69. And during the time I was at Temple, the Black Power, Black Student, Black Activist movement was going on. I was a part of that. Me and my colleagues started the Black Student League at Temple, and I edited publications for that. So that was my first taste of actually writing. Mm-hmm. I edited the newsletter, and I edited the the literary magazine. Mm-hmm. I was an English major.
Instead of curiosity, as a athlete, were you aware of John Carlos?
Oh, sure.
Can you tell me a little bit about seeing that or experiencing it?
But that was later. That was much later. Everybody in my circle was full in line with that. Mm-hmm. We loved it. because, you know, we had been doing this. When I went to Temple, the whole time I went to Temple undergrad and grad school, there were no courses on Black literature. Anytime I wanted to do a paper, I had to fight to do a paper on a Black author. And many things that I did got turned into, the professors later used them in their, when they revised their courses. But at the time, there was nothing. And so we started the Black Student League, edited the Black Paper, the Black Literary Magazine. And then later on, when I got out of school, I worked for a publication, a short-lived publication that was put out by a radio disc jockey named Jocko Henderson. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he created a magazine called Philly Talk. And I worked for that for about a year, mostly editing, but also doing some writing. when I got out of grad school, I got a teaching position at Rutgers in Camden, which is right across the river. So Rutgers, Camden. I worked there teaching Black literature.
And what was the graduate degree?
English.
English. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a master's. Mm-hmm. And so I created 4 courses over there. I taught writing, of course, because that's what I did. What is going on with this phone? I taught writing because as a graduate student, that's what we did. We had the great papers, and they gave us a composition class.
Right.
You know how they do. And so I did teach Rutgers. I was an instructor. I taught 2 writing courses, and then I created 4 courses of my own, history of Black literature in 2 parts, before and after the Civil War, Black writers in their social context, which was a sort of a Marxist interpretation of Black literature. My advisor in graduate school was a card-carrying communist who really took me under his wing and turned me on to some things.
Who was your advisor?
His name was Gaylord Leroy. Mm. Terrible teacher. Boring as crap. But he introduced me to teaching, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a whole nother story. And he introduced us to some Eastern European writers that his wife had translated. And so I worked at Rutgers for 3 years.
So how are you, I'm just curious, this is a fairly specific question, but how are you doing your research? I mean, when you're talking about the history of these black publications and black literature, how are you, presumably this isn't stuff that's on the top of the shelf at the library.
No, it's not on the top of the shelf, right? So, I mean, so, and that was the problem,
right?
That I had to do it on my own. But Philadelphia is a treasure trove of literature and a lot of stuff on African Americans, as you may know. Mother Bethel Church, it was a feeding ground for the Underground Railroad. Temple had been integrated a long, long time. University of Pennsylvania. All the universities had been integrated. They were still predominantly and overwhelmingly white, but we were there, and we didn't have to fight to get there. What we had to fight to do was to open up admissions, bring more people in, and also to change the curriculum.
Right.
And we created a program that's still there. African American Studies program is still there.
Right.
And we created that. And shortly after that, I left Rutgers. And I traveled. I spent 8 weeks in Cuba building, doing construction work, helped with the revolution there, and participated in the May Day Parade and all that kind of crap. But then later, that same in 73, the same year that I went to Cuba, when I came back, I went with another group for several weeks because there was an international conference going on in East Germany, the GDR. It was a cultural, it was a fun thing, but it was for leftists from all over the world. And I did that. And when I came back, I worked at the Tribune. I applied for a job at the Tribune before I left, and when I came back, it was there.
Had you, when you were coming up, when you were growing up, did your family read the Tribune?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you had that in your home?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tribune and Jet Magazine and Ebony.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tribune came out twice a week. It's the oldest continuously published black paper. It started publishing in 1880-something, 84, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so we had it. It came out on Tuesdays and Fridays. So I was familiar with it.
So were your parents in subscribing to those magazines, did that make them more the norm in the African American community?
They were the norm.
Mm-hmm.
They were the norm. I mean, they were not radical or anything by any stretch of imagination. My family on my mother's side were all Catholics. My mother was at a Catholic boarding school. My uncle, all her siblings, they were Catholic. One of my uncles went to St. Emma's Military Academy in Virginia. And I went to the same school that one of my uncles went to, and I ended up going to an all-Catholic boys school in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
Overwhelmingly white.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any black instructors. I never had any black teachers.
Does that include at Temple?
Yeah, never. Never. No, not one. Not one. So you kind of realize when you're doing it as a black professor what it might mean. You see people's faces when you come in the classroom.
Right.
You see a little wonder on white students and a little, oh my God, on black students' faces.
Yeah.
And they have to get acclimated for a few classes to get with it.
Well, it's funny that you say they're the ones who have to get acclimated. If you're the only person of color to walk into that room, I think a lot of people would assume that you were the one who felt you needed to adjust.
No, I've been adjusting all my life.
Right.
I went to the elementary school through eighth grade was all black, right. But we had nuns, and they were all white. And then when I went to high school for 4 years, it was the Christian Brothers. These were white. It's hard to explain it, but they're sort of like white, the male component, the male opposites of nuns.
Uh-huh.
They weren't priests,
right.
But they wore habits.
Yeah.
So, and they were my teachers there, and everybody in the school was white. It was 400 some people in my graduating class, and I think there were 7 of us. So, but in my sophomore year, I got really good with the Italians who ran the school, so I was cool. So I didn't have to adjust. I've been adjusting. There was a black professor in the English department at Rutgers when I got there. There was a black math teacher. I mean, there were black teachers there.
Right.
So, but it was overwhelmingly white. And when I went to Rutgers, the year before, there were only 14 black students on that campus.
Mm.
They took over, you know, did the whole thing. And as a result of that, they were looking for black people to come in.
Right.
And my advisor at the J School, Gaylord Leroy, turned me on to it. Said, I think I found a perfect place for you. And I went over in there, you know, that's how that happened. So at the Tribune, I worked there from 73 to 76, covering everything. I had a column for a year and a half or more called Amana at Large. I covered all kinds of things during the Frank Rizzo era. I don't know if you know about Frank Rizzo, but Frank Rizzo was a former police chief whose brother was a fire chief who became mayor for 8 years and was a homophobe, a xenophobe, a racist. Seriously, he was. This guy was, he was crazy. And during that time, we had the bicentennial celebration in Philly. And I was a part of a whole group of people who did an anti-bicentennial celebration. And in reaction to that, all kinds of things were attempted, you know, not to give us a parade permit, to keep us out, not to get, basically stop us from doing it. We did it. And we actually had more people than they did. Their estimate was 50,000. It was more. And it kept a lot of people away because Rizzo brought in armed police, these little things that looked like tanks, helicopters, and it scared a lot of people away.
Right.
Because they knew about the riots that had taken place in Philly in 64. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, during that period in the 60s, riots broke out all over the country.
Right.
And so people got scared away, and basically it was a bunch of high school bands that came for the official thing. So I was there for all of that. And during that period, I also had spent a week in Israel in the aftermath of the October War, and did a series of stories that got an award. It was interesting because the consul in Philly did like my stories, and when I went to be debriefed and talk to them afterwards in this building, this old building in Philly, and security all around it, steel doors, and I was in this room like this, you know, I was talking to this guy, and he says, I said, well, how did you like my stories? He says, I don't think I need to tell you, Mr. Romano, we're not pleased with your story. I said, why? I said, I got sources from all sides. He said, and I swear this is what he said, it was like a James Bond. You're a very clever man, Mr. Romano. I thought I wasn't going to get out of there. But I had... It was sponsored by the Israeli government. So it was a fact-finding tour, okay. But a bunch of us said, wait a minute, we're tired of being spoon-fed. Let's get some other stuff. And I had already made contacts with other people to have meetings with folks who were some Palestinians, some radical Jews, and so forth. And so I was getting all kinds of things, people they didn't want me to talk to. So, you know, it was a four-part series. They weren't pleased with that. And... so that whole time, I did that, and I also did some freelance stuff for I forgot what it's called now, but it's the PR component of the Black Press.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote stories for National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the National Black Press Association. And then I did some pub work, PR work for the other agency. And but I was fed up with the Tribune because it catered to a lot of people. You know, the Black Press, like a lot of the small press here in North Carolina, is easy to be manipulated because of advertising.
Right.
You know, you get a big advertising supermarket, what are you going to say about it? You know, if they're not up to standards and whatnot, and people are complaining, can you write a story? Yeah, it's hard.
Were there businesses in the Tribune or elsewhere that you observed that were advertising white-owned businesses in black publications, or did it tend to be black-owned businesses?
Well, no, Tribune did a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
It did a little bit of everything. I mean, and they didn't pay very much, and so I had to make ends meet by doing a lot of club reviews, taking pictures, and, you know, I would cover something like LaBelle. I don't know if you know who they are, but Patti LaBelle's group, and then there were people would come, and she was big in the gay community, so the gays would come out and regalia, and I would take a lot of pictures. And then we would do a picture page in the Tribune, and people would call, can I get a picture, can I get a picture? And so I would sell pictures on the side. And also, there was before Atlantic City became a casino, it was a place called the Latin Casino. It wasn't a casino, but it was a really plush supper club about 10 or 15 miles into Jersey, outside of Philly. And they had top people, you know, Aretha Franklin, Barbra Streisand, those kind of people. And I had to end with, I would go over there to cover it. Their opening night was Wednesday, and we would do a story to get it in the Friday's paper for the weekend. And so I would get a free pass, you know, they would, me and a date, free meal, free show, interview with the people afterwards, pictures afterwards, you know, so the whole bit. And that was the way I made ends meet and had a really good life, because I went to all the jazz clubs, you know.
Yeah.
It was like a side thing. But our big thing during that time was basically the ongoing struggle against Frank Rizzo. Mm. Frank Rizzo, you know, just to give you one big thing that he's terribly famous for, the Black Panthers were active in Philly, and under the pretense of looking for drugs or something, he raided their house, stripped them bare, and put them like up against the wall. And so, I mean, you can probably Google that, and you'll see these black men, and it's coarse, you know, with the image that brings, and everybody was enraged about that. So that was just one of the things he did. And he had all kinds of things that he had done with women. He hated gays. And there's a big statue of him in Philly, right in the downtown. He was Italian. And he was a big hero in the Italian community there, next to Rocky. And also, I covered a lot of stuff around South Africa.
Mm.
Because it was an anti-apartheid movement then. So the anti-apartheid movement was big. And then another, you know, at one point, I actually carried a little 25 automatic with me.
Is that right?
Unlicensed. I used to carry my camera bag because I was getting threats from the JDL, MOVE. I don't know if you know who MOVE is. MOVE is infamous because later on in the... in the 80s, their house was burnt down,
right,
and five people were killed, and
right,
you know, kids, they torched the whole street.
And that was when the firefighters were there, but they didn't make any effort,
yes,
to put the fire out.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And there's a whole nother story about that.
Yeah.
But that was after I left the Tribune. But they were active when I was there. And they were always trying to get you to cover a story their way. And I did several stories that wasn't their way. And, you know, they threatened me. And then I was doing stories on, at that time, the Nation of Islam Renegade Division was into the drug trade. And people were dying every day, people getting killed, and I wrote stories about that. And I was really scared of them.
Yeah.
And so I used to carry my little 25. Because I was going all in the neighborhoods and stuff covering these stupid stories. And that's primarily what I did there. So it was a combination of, you know, anti-racist stuff, the anti-apartheid stuff, and then that other stuff. And then continued after I came back from Israel to do, you know, not a lot of stories, but stories that came up about, you know, local support for the Palestinians and that kind of thing.
How did you get your information about South Africa?
How did I get it?
Yeah.
I had contacts with the American Friends Service Committee.
Right. Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with them. It's a Quaker group, not religious, it's the service wing of their organization. Their headquarters is in Philly. And they have people all over the world. And later on, I would work for them for a couple of years for their Third World Coalition, and I edited the newsletter and publications, and then after I left there, I came here. But they kept me on their board, on two of their boards, one for public relations and one for International Division, that's IDEC, the International Division Executive Committee, IDEC. And I was on it for years. And as a result, in 76, they sent me on a fact-finding tour for a month in Southern Africa in the aftermath of the Soweto riots, with the refugees running across the border. So we went to four, what they used to call the five frontline nations, which was Tanzania, Mozambique, Zambia, and Botswana, and went to the refugee camps, interviewed, you know. And the Quakers are an NGO. So they have NGO status at the United Nations. You know what NGO status is, non-government organization, And they also have lobby organizations in D.C. So whenever you did anything for the Quakers, first thing you did when you came back, before you wrote your reports, was you talk to congresspeople and stuff in D.C., and then you had a national press conference at the United Nations and participate in some of the NGO stuff. So 76, they sent me there, and then I think in 91, they sent me back to South Africa for a month. And, you know, and when I did, in 76, when I came back from the frontline nations, interviewed the presidents of had one-on-ones with Kaunda in Zambia, Nyerere in Tanzania, Chizano in Mozambique, and I actually interviewed Robert Mugabe, who is still, you know, he was a guerrilla leader then, but he's a tyrant now. and Godfrey Gongob, who was a member of SWAPO, who was a guerrilla leader, but then became president of Namibia. So, because the Quakers had good contacts. They had people there, they had Quaker communities there. They're a peace organization, and so they're always looking at alternative ways to support progressive movements, with not guns. So our job was to gain the facts, talk to some people, come back and tell them what they could do back here to organize and help, and also to identify a person or two who we thought would be good to then go around the country and speak to their constituents, because that was the other thing you had to do when you came back. You had to go around the country and talk to everybody. So, but that was down the line. But while I was at the Quakers, as I said, I edited their publications. And then, well, not their publications. They had an organization called the Third World Coalition. And I was a media person for the Third World Coalition. And that sent me to Indian reservations. I went to a Sundance ceremony in South Dakota for a week. You know, they would send you, we participated in demonstrations, we talked to people at the embassies and so forth. And of course, that was, they had an international component, so I was still able to write. When I came back from, in 76, from the Southern Africa tour, I wrote a four-part series of articles for the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the Black Press, and that went to news, you know, Black Press newspapers. And I was also teaching at Temple. Asked me to come after I quit the Tribune. Temple asked me to come, and I was teaching journalism there for 2 years, and then here. And I actually came here not for the journalism school. I came here because there was a program in AFAM studies, Rockefeller funded, called the Southeastern Black Press Association. Now, I don't know if they've got papers over here at the library.
Okay.
All this stuff is over here, probably in the Southern History Collection.
Right.
The South, well, you know what, they may have, I think Central has their papers.
That would make sense.
Yeah. But the Southeastern Black Press Institute was run by a woman named Sonia Haynes Stone, after whom the BCC is named.
Right.
And I saw a thing on the board at Temple, and I said, well, they want somebody to do something with the black press, and they want to train people and so forth. And I said, well, I mean, but what I didn't know, there was a major component for fundraising, which I hate. So I got down here, and when I found out, I said, oh, you know, Sonia, I'm really not interested. And she said, well, look, let's go interview anyway, please, please. She said, don't tell anybody. But the way it was constituted, it had affiliations with the journalism school. It was in Atham. She was actually a sociology professor, but the committee was huge. they were from all over the place, you know, including journalism. Anyway, long story short, I didn't get the job. Not because I didn't want it either. And when they asked me about fundraising, I told them the truth. And I could see Sonia's face blanch. She trembled a little bit, you know, but hey, I wasn't going to lie. And so that was it. But then Donald Shaw came to me afterwards. He said, look, we have a position of at this J school. If it stayed open, would you be? You think you might be interested? I said, well, maybe, yeah, you know. And so, long story short, that's how I ended up going over to the journalism school. But I was also a liaison for the Southeastern Black Press Institute.
Okay.
And so I used to teach the history of the black press. Later on, at the J school, we took that course away from Atham and put it into, and I redesigned it.
Mm-hmm.
So we had it in, and it's still a part of the journalism school's curriculum.
And you had come down to North Carolina once before, or you said you earlier in this interview you'd come down through South Carolina as part of your Army service.
Did you come
through North Carolina, like through Fort Bragg or somewhere else?
You know, we came on a train from D.C. It was overnight train. We slept. We woke up in the morning. I say I'm going to go back and do this. I'm absolutely sure it was North Carolina we stopped in. It was probably Raleigh, but I don't know. You have to look at the train schedules from 1964, right. You know. And I'm also have to look at the business registry from 1964 because, as I remember it, the place that when I got up in the morning, there was 14 of us. And I was in charge of the tickets. And they put me in charge of the group to get to North Carolina. We'd been sworn in Philly, so we were actually in the military. We didn't have any uniforms.
Mm.
And there was a place, and I swear, maybe my memory, but it, the Purity Bar or Purity Cafe, right there at the train station. We went in there to eat. And I went in there with, it was two other black guys, but they hadn't gotten up yet. So I went in there with all these white guys in the group. And I noticed that when I went in, I was looking over at the jukebox to play some music while, you know, and I noticed they were looking kind of nervous, and one of the little lady came and said, sir, we can't serve you in here, but if you go around the back, it's the same food. So, that was my first day in the military.
Yeah. I like that she called you sir.
Yeah, she did say
right?
sir.
Yeah.
She did say sir, and she was really, yeah, you know, apologetic about it. This is the waitress,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know. And I mean, she's a working woman, so I walked out, took the tickets.
Yeah.
Nobody's gonna eat here. And and then of course I ended up in Columbia, South Carolina. I would not go back there for another 20 some years.
Mm.
Before I ever went back there again, it was terrible. It was racist. We had this terrible place where we could go to stay for. If we got to leave, little rinky-dink place. I heard from the white guys that across town, their place was fabulous. Elvis Presley had come there, hell. You know, we had jukebox. And so I went to town once doing basic training. I never went back. Said, to hell with this. Unfortunately, after my 8 weeks of training, I got back there. They sent me back there for typing school for another 8 weeks. But I snuck some civilian clothes back with me this time and ended up playing for the basketball team. So I had a Class A pass. So I would go into town every day after practice and hang out at the two black colleges there. I can't remember what they are. There was two black colleges in Columbia, and I used to hang out with there. They thought I was a student there. I hung out there so much. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I got transferred to... No, and then I spent another 4 weeks in Indianapolis for administration school. Went to upstate New York for several months, and then went to Iran for the rest of my tour. Mm-hmm. And I was on leave, getting ready to go to Iran, and we had an emergency. They said, look, either check into your nearest post until further notice, or stay where you are and take advance leave, which you'll, you know, lose later, because it was October of 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we had to wait to see what the Russians were going to do. Now we know it was really dangerous because the missiles were already there. Right. You know, it's this stuff about they blinked and they turned. This shit was there, man, and it was targeting the whole area where I was, New York, Philly. You know. Anyway, so we got delayed, and then I went to Iran.
Yeah.
In Iran, I was there when the Ayatollah Khomeini attempted a coup, and barely got out with his life. The Shah killed all his relatives, all his friends. And he went to Rome, to Paris, to France, where he ruminated for 14 years, and then, of course, came back with a vengeance later. You know, I often think that if he had been successful, I was there, I might have been one of the hostages.
Brush with fame.
Right? Yeah, because the Shah, I mean, we had to stay in our, we didn't have barracks, we had to get our own apartments, but we got all kinds of money. And then I had black market money from selling my liquor and my cigarettes. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, but I sold them. You know, you'd have thought I was an alcoholic and a chain smoker if you looked at my cards. So, and I got on the State Department basketball team. So for 2 years, I toured the country playing basketball. And I got to all the places all over that country. Tabriz, Meshed, Yaz, Isfahan, all over the place, you know. And I got to see everything because in each place, whatever they were famous for, they would take you to see it.
Right.
You know, and I could see how they made these rugs with these little girls, with the, you know, hunched over this couple of bulbs in the ceiling. And, you know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. And then when I came back in 64, I took off. I was getting, as soon as I got back, I would get discharged because I was getting an early discharge. But I decided to spend a month in Europe. To spend a month going into, you know, Barcelona, Paris, Copenhagen, Rome. And then I got back, and on my way back, all hell broke out in New York, first ride. I think it was around August. Then shortly after that, Philly. And then in 65, 66, 67, every major city, north, south, east, and west, had a riot. You know, and so it was a whole change, you know. Then there was Kennedy was assassinated while I was there. I remember Kennedy being assassinated at night because that's when I got the word. It was night in Iran. So that's my memory of, you know, everybody remembers where they were when it was Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so coming through Europe, everybody was concerned. They were trying to put these things together between Kennedy being killed, the civil rights movement with the people being killed and hosed down and the dogs on them, and Barry Goldwater running for, you know, it was like they were putting all this in conspiracy form. LBJ from the South, and what's going on? I didn't know. I hadn't been in the States in almost 2 years.
So were you, I mean, if you're in Iran in those early years, were you getting news at all about the civil rights movement in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. Because the March on Washington was while I was over there.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So that was big news in Europe?
I wasn't in Europe.
Sorry. I guess I'm thinking of
it. Right, it was by the time when I went through Europe, when I came back. Oh, everybody knew everything. They all knew James Baldwin.
Mm.
You know, and I had been reading Baldwin. So everybody knew that, you know, because Baldwin was reporting it. And Baldwin was, you know, an expatriate, but at the same time was participating in the civil rights movement. He was writing for Ebony. Mm. You know, he had articles in the black press. And so, and Jet was covering everything. Mm-hmm. So, Europe was really up on that stuff. We got it in trickles, you know, because I was in a, you know, everybody was cleared for secret, top secret, and crypto over where I was, so we didn't get a whole bunch of shit, you know, and the internet wasn't. So, you know, what we got was trickled.
Right.
Well,
right.
From letters from people.
Right.
You know, but no, we didn't get all that firsthand stuff.
So it's after those riots in 67 that the Kerner Commission publishes this report that attributes in large way the riots to the lack of meaningful participation in the media.
Exactly, exactly. And as a result of that, right after that, shortly after that, the American Newspaper Publishers Association ANPA, the American Society of News Editors, ASNE, there's a whole bunch of them. Associated Press Managing Editors, APME, there's a whole bunch of them. And I can't remember which one of them specifically took the leadership, but they came out with this year 2000 plan. By the year 2000, they wanted to have equity. They wanted to have minorities represented in the news media in proportion to their representation in the society.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was, what was that chapter? Because the Kerner Commission report looked at everything, but it was chapter 15, I think, that actually did the media and showed the flaws and how not having folks in, you know, hurt. And so as a result of that, probably, let's see, in the 80s, it took a long time, but in the 80s, the national media said, we're going to do this. And then there was another study shortly after. Oh, and by the way, there was lots of Kerner plus 10, Kerner plus 20, Kerner, so you can look at those.
Okay.
And they keep giving you updates on how we still weren't getting it done. And then, maybe early 70s, there was something called window dressing on the set. It was a government report. It was civil rights. I can't remember who put it out now. But if you look up window dressing on the set, it was a critique of minority presence in newsrooms, in media, in TV rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And as the title suggests, there you would find them there, but you wouldn't find them behind the scenes.
Right.
And so, and you would usually be a minority woman because she covered two things. Because now the women were getting upset, and so. You get yourself an Asian woman, a black woman, a Latino woman, you got two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But behind the cameras and those kinds of things, there was nothing. And so you read window dressing on the set. It's got all the stats, it's got a study. And then I think there was a revisit of that 10 years later.
So when you arrive in Chapel Hill, I think around the same time the Ayatollah arrives back in Iran.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh. 79.
And you were there, I believe, in part because the Black Student Movement was putting pressure.
Exactly. In fact, I mean, I was at Rutgers because of the Black Student. 14 Black students took over. Okay, and then.
So you're the guy.
I'm the guy. And then, of course, you got to have to be interviewed by the radicals, you know.
Right.
You know. But see, we had already done our thing at Temple.
Right.
You know, we had already done that and gotten it established and everything. Open admissions, Black studies, the whole bit. So I knew what the, you know, how the stuff worked. And here I am. And then even later, here. In 79, you know, 10 years later, 10 years after I get out of grad school, I'm here with the same thing.
So I don't recall if you wrote a piece about sort of arriving at the Carolina Inn.
Oh, yeah, that was in the 27th, the Chapel Hill book.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
They entitled it No Way.
Yes.
Yeah, because when I came in, I-40 only went to the Governor's Inn.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't been completed. So then you got on 54.
Right.
And there was nothing on 54,
right.
Man. It was like a black hole. There was no development on it. Just, it was a dangerous highway. People used to have a little sticker saying, pray for me, I ride 54. Because there's always accidents there.
Because
people are always trying to get somewhere fast. And that little road, And so here I show up at the Carolina Inn, and then they had the guys in livery uniforms. I was like, whoa, what the fuck is this? This is a plantation house, man. And that's where they put me up. And I was like, oh, there's no way I'm coming back here.
So was that was for your interview?
For Sonya.
And that was for, okay, so that was the original interview, okay.
Yeah, and so, and that would have been in 78.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And that would have been in, it might have been 77. I don't remember when, but because I know when Don Shaw asked me about the job, and I said, well, yeah, they contacted me in the spring semester of 78 to come interview, and I couldn't come. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, if it's still open in the fall, and they called me back in the fall, that's when I actually came down to interview for the J school, and that's why I started in January. Mm-hmm. Had I been able to get free for the spring, then I probably would have started in September.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and in that time, I had some time to do a little looking at the history here, and I saw how the students had mobilized during the Red Scare times to get the speaker to speak out of the on federal land at the post office into the campus.
Right, right. Herbert Apfecker. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, I had been talking to Sonya, and then I met with her at the National Newspaper Publishers Association that fall. I attended that national meeting. And see, the thing was, one of the things that to apply for her job, that for that job, was you had to write an essay about your thoughts on the Black press. Well, by the time I sort of noticed, the deadline was there. Mm. So what I did was, in 1976, lots of stuff happened in Philly for the bicentennial. The National Newspaper Publishers Association met in Philly. And I wrote a column. It was a critical column. Criticizing them for being flunkies and, you know, catering, not standing up, blah, 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 blah. And so, at this deadline, I said, oh, I don't have a chance to write about it, but I'll give you a copy of this column. My thoughts haven't changed on this. So I gave her that, and they sent it, and that worked. Nice. So they called me in. That was my essay.
Yeah. I'm curious, obviously, Sonya Hainstone wanted you to come here. I'm curious if you remember anything about the content of your conversations when you were talking to her about making a decision about whether or not to come. Was she telling you things about what the climate was like in North Carolina or at UNC?
Well, I knew what the climate was like. I mean, we knew Joanne Little.
Yeah,
we knew Jesse Helms.
Yeah.
We knew the Wilmington 10th.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I said, I don't know if I want to come down here. And I understand everybody on my mother's side, the family's here. They're in New Bern County.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I knew about North Carolina. And plus, that was another thing. What was that? Somewhere between 73, 4, 5, 6, and 76, when I was at the Tribune, I came down here. There was a national coalition. I can't remember the initials, you know, something, but I guess racism and national repression or something. Anyway, it was a coalition. Whole gobs of people came down here to because of a woman on death row, Wilmington 10, all that. Angela Davis was here. Mm-hmm. Big wigs, and I think what's his name, who was with the Wilmington 10, Ben Chavis, I think. Yeah, and we marched around Central Prison, and we marched up to the governor's mansion in downtown Raleigh, and I covered it for the paper, you know. And what happened was, and I bring pictures, and the Klan came out. And of course, you know, it's a small contingency, but you know, I had the pictures of that. Mm. So, and the Tribune ran all of that.
So, is this like 76, 77?
It was before 76 because I stopped the Tribune at 76. I only worked the Tribune for 3 years.
Okay.
76. So, it was in 74, 75.
Because I mean, I know the Wilmington 10 story goes on and on and on for years, and there's appeals and things of that nature.
Right. But it was 74, 75.
Okay.
And I mean, you know, the articles in the Tribune.
Right, okay.
The column, and the pictures around it, including the pictures of the Klan and whatnot. And so, yeah, I knew about North Carolina, mm-hmm. and I had been here. Mm-hmm. So, no, it wasn't like I was just discovering, but this plantation thing. And then they were playing on the bell tower. Camp Town races on the bell tower. Do-da, do-da. You know, it was like, where the hell am I? Do they know what they're playing?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that you say that because, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about this recently about what kind of a place North Carolina is. Is it this progressive place or is it not? And is it red or blue or purple? And then the reputation of the state, however you want to understand that word, has always been that, you know, it's not Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
You
right,
know, right?
Right.
I don't know if you want to hang your hat on that. But
right. No, you're right. And then Chapel in particular, because Jesse Helms said this is a pat of butter and a sea of grits. No, we used to say that.
Right.
And he said he wanted to put his cage around it
so
they could watch the animals.
Yeah, so it's right. I think it was when they decided to build the zoo, and he said, you know.
Yeah, zoo.
We have to watch
the animals.
Zoo, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting to hear then that, you know, at least one outside perception was that this was not the kind of progressive utopia that progressive Southerners thought it might have.
No. And again, it's perspective because, you know, there were people in power who didn't want North Carolina to be like Mississippi and those places, you know. And so they found other ways to negotiate. There were some people in Greensboro, for example, who specifically said, we don't want this. And negotiated with the students who did their thing there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the students there, and you had the students at Shaw, who were some first students in the country to start doing that stuff.
Yeah.
But we didn't have the big stuff that went on in Alabama and South Carolina and Mississippi. And, you know, we didn't have that. But we did have that sort of systemic legal stuff going,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we had Jesse Helms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so I knew, but, you know, but Sonia had some visions about some things that she wanted and that I was really interested in. And when I couldn't do the fundraising, you know, she said, well, you know, if you come down for the journalism school, we'll arrange it so that you can still be a liaison with this. You can still work with the students in our summer project, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was okay. And I came down for her. You know, and that was one of the reasons why after she died and the students said they wanted a place for her, I worked mm-hmm. for years on that, mm-hmm. on that, you know.
Right.
I was on the, I was taking a brunt of stuff on that committee. I mean, on that advisory committee, man. I was catching flack from the students who thought I wasn't radical enough, catching flack from the people who thought I was racist, you know, I was like. And then later on, they asked me to be interim director.
Right.
Yeah. So, right. So I had a long history with that.
Yeah. So when I know that the Southeastern Black Press Institute and the Journalism Organization of Black Studies were instrumental in putting pressure on the School of Journalism to create the position
uh-huh.
or to hire.
Uh-huh.
The position. Was that unique to the journalism school? I guess I'm sort of wondering, I mean, I can sort of answer the question, or I can assume the answer, but...
I don't know, because I know there was a Black Studies program here.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So there was pressure put on to have that from the beginning, and then they get Sonia in. So they had pressure before. Okay, and then they kind of extended and said, I don't know, the kids, a person you could have talked to was here yesterday, over the weekend. His name is Sam Fullwood.
Okay.
I don't know where Sam's working. I think he's in D.C., but Sam was here.
That's Sam Forward? Like
Fullwood, F-U-L.
Ah, okay.
He graduated in 78, but he was a part of that whole thing, and he was on my search committee.
Okay.
So he kept telling us another guy, he's in Charlotte, named David Squires. David was a part of that. And there's another one named Alan Johnson. And Alan is, I think, still at Winston-Salem. I think he teaches at Winston-Salem State. He may still write for the paper there. But they were the people who were instrumental in this. Okay. And David ended up also coming to graduate school here and getting his master's here. So did Alan.
Okay.
Yeah. I was on both their committees.
Okay.
Yeah. And Alan was the first person to teach the Black Press.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you arrived on campus, you were certainly already well aware of the Black student movement and things of that nature. And what was your sort of role in relation to the BSM and Black Ink?
Well, I mean, I didn't have a formal relationship with them, but all the students had relationships with me.
Okay.
You know, they asked me to speak at certain things. Of course, I would do it. If they asked my advice on things, of course, I would handle that. And then later on, as I said, with the whole thing around the BCC, you know, I assumed some leadership in that. It's one point, one of the students, and actually she's still here. She's teaching over in communication studies. This was much later. She wanted to start a Black literary magazine. And I'd had kids come in and do that before I asked, and I would give them a series of tasks to do and come back to me, and they never came back. And she came back like the next week with all the things checked off. her name is Renee.
It's not Renee Alexander Kraft.
Yeah.
Is it? Mm-hmm. I never knew. Okay.
Yeah,
oh, cool.
She's the one.
Okay.
Yeah, she's teaching over, and she's actually teaching in the same department as her mentor, Soyini Madison.
Okay.
Cool. And she actually lives in Soyini's house. She bought the house.
Wow.
Soyini went to Northwestern. She's a distinguished professor there. Renee.
Yeah.
So Renee was, you know, she was like that. Students would come to me with ideas and stuff. I'd talk to them, feedback, and then, like I said, I gave her, well, here's what you do. And then a week later, here she comes. Okay, I did all that. What should I do now?
Yeah.
You know. So, and she started a magazine. I don't know if they still have it now, but it was a part. It was a part of the Black Cultural Center,
okay.
Saudi Umpia. I can't spell it.
Yeah, I've seen it in print.
And
I'll ask.
SAUTIMPYA or something like that. But anyway, yeah, she was the person. Yeah,
right.
She's here.
Yeah, I see her fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ask her. She'll give you all kinds of stuff about that,
yeah.
That period.
So what's the general time frame on that?
That is late 80s,
yeah,
early
okay.
90s.
Okay.
That is.
Sure.
That's much later.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you came, were you aware at all of, I mean, like I said, of course you were. What was your sense of the media environment generally in Chapel Hill or in the area?
I remember actually writing a letter that never got published to the Durham paper,
mm-hmm.
criticizing their coverage of their take on South Africa. I mean, I didn't think it was good at all.
Mm-hmm.
Truthfully, I didn't think that much better of the Carolina Times.
Mm-hmm.
I met another group of people who you might be interested in talking to, who had an independent radio station in Henderson. I mean, the guy who was responsible for the programming, getting up to fix the aerial, the whole thing, is Jim Lee.
Yeah.
You know him?
Yeah. I didn't interview him, but my colleague did on WVSP.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jim. And see, Jim was a part of all of that before
mm-hmm.
I got here with Duke. And,
right,
you know.
Right.
Yeah, and and I met them, you know, and I met them sometime. In fact, when I came back from South Africa the first time in 76, one of the people that went around the country talking was a man named Bill Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Sutton? That was Bill's last name. I have to remember. But anyway, and we brought him down here
mm-hmm.
to speak at the radio station because they were a big anti-apartheid group. And they were also on the Wilmington 10 thing. And they were all on that progressive thing. And everybody around here catered to them.
Mm-hmm.
All the radicals and progressives. And also, when I first came down here, the very first thing that happened was the Klan Nazi shootout in Greensboro.
Right.
And so people from all over the world came to that. And we mobilized and marched through Greensboro, and I was there. I think I may have written for I may have covered that. I was writing, I was freelancing for, it's actually a Marxist newspaper. I can't remember. Communist Workers Party? No, it didn't have communists in it. But it was, yeah, I used to write for them. Mm-hmm. And people came from all over for that.
Yeah.
I mean, even from this Eastern Bloc.
Wow.
Yeah. There were Eastern Bloc reporters there covering that. You know. So, because they saw the radical black movement as a partner,
sure,
a coalition partner.
Sure.
And so, and that may be one of the reasons why we got as much leeway here with legislation and stuff, because we know now that there were people here who were really concerned that we might go with the communists. You know, they were accusing us of being red anyway.
Yeah, right.
You know, they accused the black press of being red. You know, there's a radicalism and sedition among the Negro papers. That was one of the, that's in the congressional record.
Which is ironic because I'm not well-versed in the black press, but from what I've read of the Carolina Times, for instance, it seems like a fairly conservative publication.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But, you know, see, politics was so right-wing, and then you have somebody like in Philly, you had a Rizzo. Nationally, you had J. Edgar Hoover,
right,
who was totally paranoid and sick about everything. And so, from his perspective, all of these people needed to be shut down. You know? I remember some of the research I did, I was looking at an editor from Ebony, wrote Hoover. It was who I'm interested in doing an article on crime does not pay. You know, what can you help me with? Okay, so they're sending this around. You know, well, not it isn't the FOI files and half of us blacked out. But in the margin, somebody writes, he's probably of dark skin complexion. This is a Negro paper. I mean, that wasn't got to do with anything. You know, but, I mean, and they didn't black that out, which is so stupid. So he was paranoid.
Yep.
And he had them, you know, there's been stuff published about the Red Scare, the black press, mm-hmm. And how the black press was, I mean, one time, I've never done it, but I never got my files. But I did get files on the black student movement, where I was. And in the files, there's a letter that someone writes directly to Hoover, a woman. I was at the supermarket, and this pamphlet was, this newsletter was being handed out, and I think it's so disgraceful and radical, and, you know, and it was, you know, and I was reading it, and I said, oh, this is pretty hip. And it was me. I wrote the damn thing, right? Anyway, as a result of that, he directed the Philadelphia Bureau to spend months and months and months and months and months tracking this organization. You know, that COINTEL program of his was crazy.
Right.
And so, yeah, they thought the black press, anytime the black press was critical of the federal government, and especially during the Vietnam era, you know, that was big. And we wrote a lot about that. That was the other thing I did at the Tribune. Was constantly doing the thing around people coming back wounded, critiquing the. I forgot I did a little series on that, man. You know, criticizing the. And then I'll tell you another paper you look at for that period. It's not for civil rights, but Muhammad Speaks.
Mm-hmm.
Muhammad Speaks. I did a paper on this once where I looked at. Can't remember the exact dates now, but for a period of over 5, 6, 7 years, it came out weekly.
Mm-hmm.
There was not one issue that came out that did not have at least an anti-Vietnam
article, cartoon, or picture.
They would take stock pictures, you know, off the wire, and then the caption. Here are another case of when they have blacks running, they are misguided brothers, inflicting harm on their relative, on their brothers, mm-hmm. who they don't recognize as themselves, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah. So it was very explicitly connected with a sense of the Black Freedom Movement and international sort of. Relationship between oppressed people of color.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. I mean, and consistently. And even to the actually criticize, and they were also critical of King.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd see that wouldn't be King, but it would be a minister. You know, and he kind of looked a little like King, and he was always, you know, kissing up the white folks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they criticized black folks, you know, who weren't with the afros.
Mm.
They showed them with big afros and high platform shoes and all this looked like dandies.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were very critical, you know, because the nation, short haircuts, bow ties, right. Very clean suits, right. You know.
So was this part of this divide that I certainly can't claim to understand even the beginnings of it, but this divide between a black nationalist movement that was very politically oriented and a sort of black cultural movement that was about a sort of cultural presence?
Yeah, I mean, some of it started with SNCC.
Right.
You know, because they didn't want to turn the other cheek.
Right.
I mean, when I first went to Temple in 59, I was a member of the NAACP,
mm-hmm.
and we were picketing at Woolworths in support of what was going on down here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we got a letter saying, you know, we have a black person and we'll hire another one if you stop picketing.
Interesting.
And we were like, it's not about that.
Yeah.
It's about what your organization represents in the South.
Right.
And you know, that was in 59. I was like 17 years old. and so, you know, to some extent, that was sort of radical, okay, mm-hmm. because it wasn't popular, and you had to make connections, you know, it was more than just saying these people are, you know, you had to make some connections about the parent company and what was going on in the South and all that. That was more difficult to explain to people, you know, and you had to get that together. And then by the time you got to SNCC, their whole thing was, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. And then it rose to the Black Power thing. And then demonstrations of Black Power. And so it depended on which university you were at, how savvy the leaders were, whether it was all cultural. And, you know, in any kind of a movement, a lot of times people have what they think are common goals, but the common goals are pretty simple. And then when it gets more complex, there's splits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what was happening. And in the Nation of Islam, which is really conservative, if you track their roots, you know, they're coming from Booker T. Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Through Marcus Garvey, through Elijah Muhammad. Do for self, separate, build businesses, shops and stuff like that. Yeah, okay. But then they were also taking this anti-imperialist stand.
Right.
And that was because of individual cartoonists and individual people who were working with them.
Right.
Okay. It wasn't, as I understand it, a blanket consensus, you know.
Sure. Just out of curiosity, were you aware of Robert Williams's broadcasts?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Out of China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, you know, he had connections with Cuba, and you'd been there, and I'm mm-hmm. not sure how much overlap or not there was.
We would cover some of that. I mean, I would do that in the paper. Yeah, I was aware of that.
Yeah. Speaking of one version of radicalism.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So did you listen to WVSP?
It went much farther.
Yeah. It had a pretty strong signal, but yeah, that's a little much to ask.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know his wife.
Yeah, Valeria.
Valeria. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Because mm-hmm. she went in with Z Smith for a while, and I don't know who she's with now.
She was at Golden Leaf for at least a little bit. But I'm not sure if she's mm-hmm. still there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've actually loaned us recordings.
Oh, okay.
That we're trying to digitize.
Oh, good.
So people can listen to them again.
Yeah. And their son, Mark?
I don't know Mark.
Mark works at Haytai.
Okay.
He's the organizer for the Blues Festival every year.
Oh,
all
right.
Yeah, Mark Lee. Mm-hmm. I saw him a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. I went to a concert there. Mm-hmm. You know where Haytai is? Yeah, the cultural center. He mm-hmm. works there. Yeah.
All right. Good to know.
Mm-hmm. In fact, he was one of the first students in our summer program for the Southeastern Black Press Institute.
Oh, okay.
Because when we had the opening day for the parents to come so we could tell them what the rules were, I saw Jim and Valeria. I said, "What the hell are you guys doing here?" They said, "Mark's here." I said, "Who's Mark?" They said, "Our son." I said, "Oh! That's your son." I didn't even know it. He got in on his own merit.
Right.
Because he was at, I think he graduated from Xavier. But yeah, he was he was a kid then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was surprised to see Jim and Valeria. I didn't even know that was their kid.
Yeah. So I'm curious if you remember anything about VSP.
Well, like I said, I bought Bill's. Anyway.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I listened to all of those. I listened, they had jazz, they had blues, mm-hmm. but then they had the, and I also wrote for Africa News.
Right.
And I did some things for them. And Africa News at the time was here. That was the other thing that got me, that Africa News was here, this radio station was here, Sonya was telling me about stuff. Mm-hmm. I said, there's some stuff happening here. I'd gotten introduced to the Regulator Bookstore. Mm-hmm. I said, "Whoa, Africa News." And I'd been looking at Africa News for years for stuff. We subscribed to that.
And when you were in Philadelphia.
Oh yeah, because
is that Reed and Tammy Kramer, or is that
Yeah. Because they had actually, they had relationships, working relationships with the Quakers.
Right. Because they had done service in South Africa, which mm-hmm. is maybe.
I don't know if it's South Africa, but it's Southern Africa. Somewhere. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Reed and Tammy.
Great. So you were reading Africa News in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we were using it because they had an Africa News. It was like they called it a press service.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But it was print.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It came out every week.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so
I've forgotten about that. There were other connections that I already had.
Yeah. Oh, that's very good to know. And well, tell me about the Regulator. Did you buy books there or meet people?
Well, I met people there, and at the time, Africa News was down in the back of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it was all in the same building.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I interviewed Tom Campbell last month, who still owns it and is there regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to him about the role the Regulator played in that kind of cultural world and as a place.
If you wanted to get those kinds of books, there were only two places you get it, Regulator and that other big bookstore that went out of business.
Intimate?
No.
That was
the big book that claimed it was the biggest something in the South.
Oh man, okay.
Yeah, they had everything in there. They had textbooks, but they also had all kinds of stuff. It's right at the it's a series of businesses there at that building now. Okay. But I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got to be introduced to all of those folks.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've been here for the demonstration against the criminal justice system.
Right.
So.
Right.
I didn't come here completely cold.
And they WVSP gave plenty of coverage to the the PCB dump in Warren County that Ben Chavis was involved in that movement.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years after you arrived, the North Carolina Independent would have started publishing, which you know.
And later. I was on there, and I was on their editorial board for years.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. And I wrote some pieces for them.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at
and Southern Exposure.
Oh, of course, right. So the Institute for Southern Studies would have been operating in the Southern Exposure.
Yes.
Comes along.
They were all here.
Right.
Yeah. The Institute for Southern Exposure, African News, Regulator Bookstore, WVSP, mm-hmm.
North Carolina Anvil.
Not in the right familiar with them now. And Sonya. Yeah, I said, "Whoa, there's stuff going on there. I could come down there, and so it was okay."
Yeah.
But my first impression was
Well, for better or worse, it took me a while. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it took me a while talking to Sonya and then making the connections with the other stuff, you know. Because I don't think I knew that African News was coming out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think I knew that before.
Yeah. And they're still publishing.
Yeah, I mean, once I start looking to see what's going on down here, Sonya was talking to me. And I said, oh, okay, all right. And then I had another friend who had come up to Jersey to do some stuff with the Black People's Unity Movement in Camden, named Bertie Howard, B-E-R-T-I-E. She's in South Carolina now.
Okay.
And she and Jim would know how to get in touch with her. They were really close, and they were part of that. She went to Duke.
Okay.
And they were part of all of that. And what's his name? Oh God. Okay, I'll have to think about it. Because it was another... I see his face. It'll come to me. But at any rate... Yeah, I knew a lot of... I made some connections with some people.
Yeah.
So when I did decide to take the job, it was, you know, that was all right. And I could immediately start doing things again.
And you said earlier that you had been adjusting all your life to this idea that you were the first Black instructor, faculty member in the School of Journalism wasn't something that was uncomfortable or new to you.
No, as a matter of fact, a few years ago, they did a whole thing on the history of the J School. They interviewed all of us and everything, and then apparently they sent it out to. Hold on a minute.
Sure.
Hey, honey. Hello. Yeah, nothing. I'm all right now. I was trying to get.
So you were talking about Bertie Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And
see the guy. What's his name? His African name at the time was Changa.
Oh my gosh.
Donald Baker.
Donald Baker. Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, he was another part of that.
Yeah. My colleague interviewed him a few years ago. Yeah. Because he had been at WAFR, which mm-hmm. I don't think they would have. They weren't still broadcasting.
No, they weren't. No.
'79.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was another one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and see, I knew all those guys. All those
people.
Yeah,
okay, okay.
They were all my friends when I first came here.
Yeah, yeah. So you were very quickly plugged into this network of activist journalists.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask it anyway. But you know, one of the things that I'm interested in is this sense of self-definition among activists and among journalists. And there are people who are writing for the Indie, for instance, who consider themselves journalists. You know, through and through.
Mm-hmm.
But they were writing on subjects that were kind of activist subjects,
mm-hmm.
fair housing environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then there were activists
mm-hmm.
who saw themselves entering journalism
right.
to do activism.
Yeah, that was me.
So that's your sense.
I've said that at forums, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here, it was some kind of a forum at the Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
And Gerald Horn was a part mm-hmm. of that. And he and I were both in agreement. You know Gerald Horn.
I mean, I can't say I know him. I know who he is. But, yeah.
And you know he ran the Black Cultural Center.
Right.
For, yeah.
Right.
And I knew him before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I couldn't believe he was applying for that job. I called him. I said, Jerry, are you so serious for that? He said, oh, yeah, I wouldn't have done it if I had. I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, because I was on the search committee, search is closed. I told him, I said, I don't care who you, I'm pushing for this man. He's in Texas now.
Okay. And he's always been, I mean, his interest, if I'm not incorrect, is in this sort of international scope of civil rights generally in the
mm-hmm.
movement.
And you should talk to Gerald because
yeah.
Gerald has written for the Black press.
Okay.
If you look at Gerald's CV, it'll floor you. You won't be able to believe that a person could produce what he produces in such volume.
I know that he's prolific, yeah.
And just a part of it, there will be probably 10 pages of just op-ed pieces that he's written for newspapers, half of whom are the Black press.
Okay.
I mean, he's the most prolific people that nobody's heard of.
Right.
Because he never pushed himself like Dyson.
Because
they were both here at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Michael Eric Dyson was in charge of the Institute for African American Studies, and Gerald was in charge of the Black Cultural Center. And the 2 years that I took over both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were here at the same time.
Speaking of the press, I think it was Well, Julian Bond, you know, of course, you know, has said that, you know, radio, more so than the press, was such a mass kind of culture phenomenon that it was particularly effective in getting activist messages across. And part of the reason for that was just because black presses tended not to publish daily, whereas the radio was always on.
Yeah, except that the black press had a pass-around rate.
Oh, uh-huh.
5-1 or 6-7-1 in some cases.
Interesting.
And you didn't throw it away.
Right.
And it was in the beauty shop.
Right.
And it was in the barbershop.
So it was always on.
It was always on. You know, it wasn't always up to date, but it would come out the next week. It was behind on that in that sense. But no, it was always on. And even now, if you go to a black barbershop, there's some ebonies in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and black enterprises now, too, and essences. But no, the black press stays in those places.
Mm-hmm.
And you would never throw it away. You never read the Tribune and threw it away. You saved it because somebody else would want to read it.
Right.
And so, and it had this other value because if you were looking for a job or if you're looking for a place to stay or a house to rent, you didn't have to worry what's going to happen when I show up. Are they going to say it was taken?
Right.
If it's in the black press, it's possible you can get it.
Right.
And so that was there. And it had always been a pass around instrument because in the old days, the Pullman porters used to distribute it.
Well, I recall people telling stories about, you know, the porters going through, you know, the segregated South on those north-south lines, you know, through Chicago and Kansas City, et cetera, and throwing the papers off the train because they wouldn't stop in the, you know,
right.
in certain places.
And, that's and, how and the post it. Office wouldn't take them.
Mm, right.
You know, it was illegal, of course, but the local post, they didn't take a shit off throwing it away.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
And that's how people learned about Emmett Till and other
people, sure.
Right?
Yeah, well, they learned about Emmett Till through Jet,
and
really.
Through Jet, yeah, sure.
That picture, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, there was an Ebony piece on WVSP where they had, you know, a photo of Jim and Valerie. And,
oh, really?
I'll send you the picture.
Oh, when was that?
Gosh, you know, I want to say, Mike, if I had to guess, I would say it was 76, 77, you know,
oh,
right
no,
after
I didn't
it,
know that. Yeah.
Yeah, right after it started broadcasting. Yeah.
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 Huh.
There's also this notion, especially, and this is more in connection with the civil rights movement of the 60s, that black issues, to use a phrase that we could talk about at length, right, only get covered if black people are victims. So this idea was used profitably by civil rights leaders who got pictures of people being bitten by dogs on it, right? But when the narrative changed, and really as a result of the success of that strategy, black people began appearing in newspapers as actors rather than people who were being acted on, or as the beaters rather than people who were being beaten on.
Well, the black press also always had a reputation in the black community about covering crime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they always did that. In fact, the Chicago Tribune used to do it with red headlines.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, no, they always, in fact, a lot of the really middle class people who loved Ebony and would not read Jet, and stop reading the black newspaper except for the social pages and the, you know, deaths and stuff, didn't like it because it's always so much violence in it. They did not like that.
Interesting.
And so, you know, some newspapers had that, and some newspapers carried that reputation long after they had toned it down. It just stayed with them. And so it always covered crime in the black community. If you look at the Pittsburgh Courier, the Chicago Defender, the Philadelphia Tribune, the Norfolk Journal and Guy, any of those papers, and here, you look at some of the papers here, you'll see that during the Civil Rights Movement, they were covering the Civil Rights Movement, but they were also covering local crime. You know,
yeah.
Somebody stabbed
yeah.
somebody or got
yeah.
killed out,
yeah.
they covered that crap.
Yeah. I guess it's sold them like it's
sold.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The model that they used for years was the model of the Chicago Defender. You know, Robert Abbott, he was really a slick man.
Mm.
He knew how to, you know. As a matter of fact, I mean, you know, it says that he's that conservative. The black press is really conservative. But sometimes you have a person on there like I was on the Tribune, and we had a couple other people on there who would do radical kinds of stuff. And to get it mixed, and you get a mixed. The editors, if they got readers, they didn't care, you know.
Right.
But the Chicago Defender, for example, remember, that's a business. Newspaper's a business. They weren't really initially supportive of the Pullman Porters. A. Philip Randolph threatened them, reminded them, you know, we deliver your papers. And that's right. And that's really right. How they got him to change his position.
One thing that strikes me, if you read, for instance, the Carolina Times for any stretch of time, especially really before the movement,
mm-hmm.
The degree to which it seems, in a way, to be aimed towards a white readership,
mm-hmm.
just
mm-hmm.
to represent the black community.
Yeah. There's that element in the black press, too. Sort of, on the one hand, a copycat, on the other hand, trying. You know, Robert Abbott, just around the Depression time, had a magazine. It only came out for 3 years, but he called it a magazine that's different, and he wanted to show the positive side of black life. So he covered the fraternity sororities. He had articles in there, historical articles mm-hmm. by Schoenberg,
mm-hmm.
And he covered the black college tennis and stuff like that. You know. I actually think it was a model for Ebony for later, mm. and when Johnson created Ebony, it was something that he wanted people to put on their coffee tables,
yep.
You know, and every cover, you know, a celebrity, a politician, you know, and it's all positive. You know, as a matter of fact, Ebony was accused of not really covering hard news like apartheid, the anti-apartheid movement, you know, it was a nice coffee table stayed, and then later on he was able to do some of that with Jet, you know, mm-hmm. turn the other part of it with Jet. He was very clever, very good businessman, but yeah, it was not, you know, it covered a lot of firsts. That's always a story. The first, you know, I got distracted I was talking about how they wrote the history of the journalism school, and apparently they put it out in some of the alumni stuff. And my son's an alum, mm-hmm. and he called me. It's about 3 or 4 years ago. Dad, you were the first black person. I said, oh yeah. He said, how come you never told me? I said, well, what was I gonna say? You know, son, I'm the first black professor. You know, so
sit down, I have something to tell you.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. So, but I guess, you know, you need to write your history, I guess, so people know stuff. They put stuff on there. I mean, and people were telling me, I just heard that you never told me about what was. I said, well, I've known you for 10 years and you never told me any of this. It never occurred to me to be a big thing. I said, my thing would be, why in 1979 was I the first?
Yeah. So, I mean, so speaking of that kind of issue, and we'll wrap up so we can both go to our respective obligations. Mm-hmm. You know, can you give us a state of the field at the moment as far as the visibility of people of color in the media and the roles of people of color in the media?
Well, I mean, now... we're all over the place, and to some extent we can control our own image because of Twitter and
right.
You know, all of that. I mean, Serena Williams, Shaq, Tiger Woods, they do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
They bypass their agents,
mm-hmm.
you know, and everybody gets on their Twitter feed because they won't know what's happening. It's mandatory for reporters at the Washington Post, New York Times, to have a Twitter account, to have a LinkedIn account, to have a Facebook account, and maybe even to have some of the others, you know? But they have to have them now, and they have to be savvy with this crap.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, they won't get the story. And so, because of the internet and social media, a lot of famous people are controlling their image now. And so that's one part. And the simple fact is, print newspapers are going out of business.
Right.
Okay? There are no afternoon papers in this country at all. No afternoon dailies, period. and some of the major ones, Times Picayune, Christian Science Monitor, they're gone. And they still haven't figured out a way to make money on the internet. So social media, the internet, TV, radio, and not even radio really, but, you know, podcasts maybe. That may be something new coming up. But I think that, and then when you look at the reactions to the things that happened in California and Florida, and, you know, immediately you get the attention, and you can force the mainstream media to cover it, because otherwise they're going to be beat by the internet. So I think we're more empowered now. I think we're much more empowered. And actually, there's nothing, if you're industrious and aware, there's nothing that you can't find out about in this world now. I mean, there's no way there's a conspiracy to keep you away from this, that, or the other. As long as you have the internet, and as long as you have access to all of these things. Now, we've seen that with Arab Spring, we've seen that with China. They go around it, and then when their governments try to stamp, mm-hmm. they still go around. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can do it. Stop it now. It's out of control. Yeah. There's a little bit of anarchy going on. And so, and I think there are actually some room for some black media folks to make a business even in this, you know. I mean, right now you've got this, what is it? They've got some black websites and things, but, and I have a really good friend who's been in business now for 12, 13 years with her, seeingblack.com, Esther Everam, out of D.C., S-E-E-I-N-G, black.com. I've learned some stuff for them, too. Mm-hmm. And Esther comes out of Philly. She's a young woman. She's in her early 50s. Went to Columbia, went to U.S., you know, got a master's at Columbia, worked at Newsday, worked at Washington Post, worked at New York Times, and just got tired of it and decided she wanted to do her own thing. And so about 12, 13 years ago, she started this publication. And it's still going.
It's a good run for an independent publication.
Yeah, and meanwhile, she's done independent stuff with Huffington Times and stuff like that. And she does interviews for, she does it in TV, the movie interviews for, I can't remember who, but a black website. Okay. She's got a book out called We Gotta Have It. And it's about, and it's really a collection of her columns from her website over 10 years or so critiquing black film. Yeah, so you have there's a niche for something to happen. Nobody, no newspaper is making money online,
right?
And they're just going out of business. I mean, unfortunately, I don't know what that means for the public. You know, I mean, like I said, everything's out there. You can learn anything you want to learn, but if you're lazy and you're used to having really quick stuff, you're not going to be informed. Mm-hmm. And that's the paradox there. You've got more information than you ever wanted, but at the same time, you're conditioned not to want it.
It's interesting that along with the rise of Twitter, there's the rise of this long-form journalism and this partnership journalism that seems to be on the opposite end of that spectrum, mm-hmm. Where people, there seems to be a hunger of some kind for in-depth.
But it's not with the masses.
Yeah, right.
that's the problem. Right. It's with a group.
Yeah, I guess that is an elite sort of style of taste. But it's interesting to see both of them flourish on either end of the spectrum. In the middle, you've got all those. You've got the New York Times and the Washington Post that are struggling and putting up paywalls. Walls, and
and then you got TMZ. That's
right. Exactly. That's way up there.
Yeah.
And they're doing investigative work. In addition to their other proclivities.
Right. I mean, there's room.
Yeah.
There really is room. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all fills out, because right now, it's flux. We don't know what's going to come out at the other end. We don't even know who's going to survive at the other end. and what it's going to look like. The innovators, this is a good time for the innovators to come through with something. There's an app for that.
I think that's a good note to conclude on. I'll just say thank you very much indeed for talking to me, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk more another time.
Okay.
All right.